You're listening to The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heidmark at RadioArian.com.
This is your host of The Daily Traditionalist, Matthew Heimbach. I am glad to be here today. I'm joined by Dr. Matthew Johnson. And we've got an exciting show today that we've got planned. And we're going to kick it off by talking about the American election. What else? Because it has implications all around the world. The first thing I want to discuss, of course, is Hillary Clinton's health. This has been a topic that has been going around. And usually, of course, you know, when I see on my social media accounts, I've got a lot of Facebook friends that are kind of more normal, traditional conservatives who fall into conspiracy theories. And if they were right about every story they posted, the world would have ended, the FEMA camps would have been opened, and everything. We'd be living in some dystopian nightmare. Well, I mean, we are living in a dystopian nightmare, but in some sort of Terminator-style reality. So I take things with a grain of salt, but I've been watching these videos more and more about Hillary Clinton's health and seeing her giving speeches where she's getting into all these coughing fits. She doesn't look healthy. She hasn't held a press conference in weeks now. Donald Trump is holding them all the time. Anything she does is so controlled and sanitized, it's kind of unbelievable. And she's even hacking up giant loogies of phlegm, it looks like, at a speech in Ohio into her water glass. So she just doesn't look like she's in the best shape. So, Dr. Johnson, first of all, how are you? And what do you think is going on with Hillary Clinton?
I'm doing well. Thanks. Thanks, Matt. I remember in 1992, an election, I was with Pat Buchanan in New Hampshire that year. The Democratic frontrunner was Paul Tsongas, former governor of Massachusetts. And he had beaten cancer several years earlier. And the press essentially repressed his campaign, driving him, you know, out of it, essentially, on the basis of his health. Because he had cancer at one point. There's no way that we could trust him with the presidency. It could come back at any time, which, by the way, it did in his case, unfortunately. And so we cannot have Paul Tsongas. Now, he was a very conservative Democrat. And so, of course, clearly that they're not, that principle isn't being applied today. It was just a very convenient way to get rid of a candidate that came out of nowhere to dominate the Democratic Party. Hillary Clinton is unelectable. I mean, not just the health issue, but the emails and the dead bodies that keep piling up. Even those in her own party are rejecting her. Never mind what happened to Bernie at the convention and just before it. And yet she's neck and neck with Donald Trump in some polls. I'm certain these polls are rigged. I don't think these polls are honest. But even if they were, Trump under polls, just like David Duke used to in Louisiana, by, you know, 5-10%. So these polls cannot be trusted. They're more propaganda than anything else.
Well, exactly. I mean, pardon me on that, a little tech thing. But I mean, that's the thing that's very interesting for us to be able to look at is all the polls. You know, they were saying now for weeks, for instance, that Donald Trump was being crushed, absolutely blown out by Hillary Clinton. And now they're doing more polls, and even the CNN polls are putting Donald Trump ahead now by half a point, and a half, 2 points, 3 points even, and all these different polls. So if the polls are there, that tells us with how rigged this system is, that means he's likely blowing out Hillary Clinton when it comes to support amongst the people. Now, what have you seen in comparison to that? The actual level of support, because, you know, a good metric, I think, it's not everything, but if you just look at Trump rallies have absolutely been filling stadiums in all these states, in swing states, these crucial swing states, bringing out white working class voters, in the deep South, in the West, everywhere Donald Trump goes, he fills a stadium. And Hillary Clinton, of course, when she had a veterans event, just a few weeks ago, I believe, they had to close all the camera angles, make them really, really narrow, because there was barely anyone with her. So the level of enthusiasm, what do you think that the clear difference? There's an absolute clear difference between it. And I saw in a poll that Trump is 15 points ahead on trust. And that's a big issue, because who would trust Hillary Clinton at this point? So where do you think the enthusiasm level lies and what that means for actual popular support between the two candidates?
You know, I know a shocking number of Democrats. You wouldn't realize that, but it's true. Not one of them like Hillary. They like Bernie or someone else. And every one of them also says that none of their Democratic friends like Hillary. It has more to do with what happened, you know, rigging the convention votes more than anything else. But then, you know, they can't deny that the bodies are piling up. You know, that's becoming so ridiculous, it can't be a coincidence. And the talk right now among the Democrats is, off camera, I'm sure, is who can replace her in time for November. I guess the other strategy on their part is to promote this libertarian tool. The man is nowhere is he a libertarian. He's against pretty much everything libertarianism stands for. And it's all they could talk about is pushing this guy in any way to get votes away from Trump. So there's one or two strategies. There's a little bit of me that thinks that they might try to replace her before the election.
Well, and, you know, with Gary Johnson, for instance, because I was a Ron Paul libertarian. Many of us in the alt-right and the white nationalist community, you go through libertarianism and you eventually realize that the only way to maintain the freedoms that we care about so much, I mean, going back to English common law, going back to traditional America, can only be had in a high trust, homogenous society. That's the only way you can have the things that you want. You know, if you want to make America great again, it can only happen within a homogenous society, which is an actual nation, not this multicultural empire that can only be held together really by force. So I went through my libertarian stage, and Ron Paul, of course, was the peace candidate. He was very much interested in reducing our footprint around the world and being able to really have power return to the states to determine their own affairs. You know, he's talked positively of the Confederacy. He's spoken in front of Confederate flags and things like that. Compare that to Gary Johnson, where Gary Johnson is actually had an absolute meltdown when the term illegal immigrant was used in an interview with him. And he's cucking so far to the left. I don't see, you know, when he's saying that that churches, and specifically businesses shouldn't be allowed to refuse service to anyone. That goes against the libertarian principle of private property, of being able to determine who you're going to do business with. That fundamentally goes against that. When he's basically, you know, telling Christians they have to abide by these principles, he's standing up for every policy really of the Democratic Party. And that's why I think they're really promoting him. They're not attacking libertarianism. Gary Johnson is not receiving any of the hate, especially from the leftist media, that Ron Paul was in 2012 and 2008. So do you think, I mean, it sounds like you do, but what has happened to libertarianism? Because it seemed to me in the span of 4 years, it's completely imploded, because the right-leaning libertarians have all become actual nationalists. We've all evolved out of the libertarian process and become nationalists like, we all are, or members of the alt-right. And the Libertarian Party seems to have just been totally dominated now by social justice warriors who use these really Soviet terms about freedom. You know, it's just like how the Soviet Union, on paper, was the freest nation on the planet, according to their constitution. But all of those buzzwords meant nothing when it came to the repressive regime they won. I mean, has libertarianism in America almost become this sort of Soviet mentality of using all these buzzwords that have no correlation to what they're actually talking about and actually enforcing a more totalitarian control? I mean, just looking at Gary Johnson's position on having no borders, not being able to secure, our immigration problem, forcing businesses to do business with people they don't choose to, that you got to sell your house or rent your apartments or something, even to people who you don't want to. There is no private property under the system. Has libertarianism kept the language but completely abandoned all of its principles?
Well, I'm not sure about libertarianism, but I certainly know about Johnson himself. Libertarianism, I don't think, has changed, but he certainly is no spokesman for it. My impression, the good form of, I never had a libertarian phase. I was kind of a human events type conservative in college, and then the Buchanan campaign, and I never left. You know, I'm still part of that, you know, Sam Francis kind of mentality. And I never use words like alt-right or anything else. It's kind of just like a play of conservative, nationalist, that kind of thing. But I know what you mean. Ron Paul gave me the impression that the state is pushed out of the way, but there's an void after that. Traditional institutions then fill that gap. That's what libertarianism is, that the older institution, the state should have no role in marriage, the church should. And that was always my impression with Ron Paul. With this guy, now he's just come out in favor of TPP, which is, that was the last straw. If I had any possible trust he was a legitimate candidate, it was gone after that. Nothing could be any less libertarian than this massive bureaucracy and a new court system that could override any national law, for better or for worse. When he came out for that, and it seems, and I'm noticing that he, my personal opinion, is that he is uncomfortable. They promised him fame and fortune if he plays along. And he's gotten that. Anything to, you know, to try to take votes away from Trump. But I get the impression, looking at him and hearing him, that he's not comfortable with this role. Because under normal circumstances, I'm not sure he would say these things. But there seems to be a contract, and we'll give you this tremendous political fame in exchange for you supporting them. And so when he came out in favor of TPP, that just started to make sense. I don't think if he was a presidential candidate, he would accept it at all. So, and I think he's increasingly uncomfortable in that role. His purpose, and as soon as this election is over, you'll never hear from the guy again.
Well, and that's the thing. If you look like the Never Trump people tried Ed McMullen, who absolutely looks like some bizarre alien, who, of course, worked for Goldman Sachs and was a CIA operative and all these things. They tried to get him as the Never Trump candidate, but they started too late. So they weren't able to get him on the ballot in more than a handful of states. So it seems to me that the Never Trumpers are backing Gary Johnson, like you said, just to be able to take votes away from Trump. And you know, the idea of something I wanted to bring up next is Donald Trump was just endorsed by 88 admirals, former generals, high-ranking military guys who have actually been in the service, some of whom have actually fought for this country, and they're backing Donald Trump. And, you know, historically, you know, look at 2008 to 2012, the military was very supportive of libertarians because the libertarian perspective under, like, Ron Paul was to bring our boys home, to put them on the border, to stop engaging in all these wars, to have a strong foreign policy of peace where we're still strong, can defend ourselves better than any other nation. But it's done with this spirit of wanting tranquility in the world. But Gary Johnson is not getting that level of support from the libertarians, or from the military, pardon me. And Hillary Clinton, of course, isn't. So a lot of this has to do with Russia. I was listening to NPR just this morning as I was playing with my son. I had the radio on, and they were talking about how Trump is a tool of Russia and how, for the first time in 70 years, an American presidential candidate has spoken well of Russia and all these things. So what do you think this means for the military apparatus? Because, of course, the military is the ultimate show of force for the state. That all of these former military personnel and so many military personnel who are active duty are supporting Trump over Hillary Clinton or the supposed libertarian because he seems to be the only one that has a sane foreign policy.
You know, the ancient Greek polis, one of the more significant aspects of it was that the people who voted for war at any given time were precisely the ones who had to go fight it. And that's not the case in modern democratic systems. There's so much to say here. It's frightening that Hillary Clinton has already threatened Russia with war. Both parties are in favor of it. And yet on no planet and no solar system could the U.S. win against Russia and China because it would automatically be a war with China according to their treaties. They have their own alternative NATO, in essence. And of course, I would also include North Korea and Iran and Belarus and a whole bunch of other places that are in favor that are a part of that treaty organization. Kazakhstan, you know, the ninth largest country in the world, is a part of the SCO. They would also be a part of it. So this would be a global, massive war. God knows, hundreds of millions killed. And Hillary Clinton is talking about it in a very offhanded way. Like, this is like invading Grenada again. And so the military it would be against it. That they've supported libertarians in the past because they don't want to fight this. None of these wars are there any American interests at stake. They don't even know where these places are. You know, if they're fighting in eastern Ukraine, they don't know who the good guys are. The only two allies the U.S. has, Japan and Great Britain, and the body bags start coming home in piles, they're going to start asking, what are we fighting for here? There's no American interest involved in any of these areas. Now,
they don't have any military, not to cut you off, but something just to throw in there, is that none of America's allies, say if we got in this globalist struggle, have militaries. The French, when they were bombing Libya, ran out of bombs after like 2.5 weeks. The Brits just decommissioned their last aircraft carrier. In Germany, their military has completely shrunk. That's not an effective fighting force. When they do NATO drills, I was reading how for some of their armored vehicles, they paint broomsticks black to put them out the sides of their military vehicles because they don't have enough machine guns to equip the armored vehicles, the limited amount that they actually have for these war drills. So that when it would come to a fight between the Atlanticists versus the Eurasianists, the Atlanticists only have America in our fighting force, and we're tired. We're tired of war. I don't think anyone could actually believe that the American people have the morale to want to engage in another Afghanistan or Iraq, let alone a world war against a nation we have no reason to fight it in the first place, is a Christian nation, and who's actively wanting peace. That there would be no way for us to fight this war, and all of our allies, who then we would be forced to defend, really have no ability to defend themselves because America has been subsidizing all of these nations, so they wouldn't need militaries. And we haven't wanted them to have militaries, so America could really dictate their national policy and their international policy. So the extended American empire, which is the Atlanticist empire, only has one nation that has the soldiers and the military capability to fight, and we're tired, and our military is falling to pieces. With all the money we spend, so much of our, I know guys that are in the military who are party members, and they're talking about repairing planes and stuff like that, and how our air fleet is falling apart and stuff like that. So we don't even have the military necessary to beat Russia, let alone be able to defend all of Western Europe and NATO, to defend South Korea, and then engage in an offensive struggle, unless we're going to jump into some sort of nuclear apocalypse, which that wouldn't benefit anybody.
You're absolutely correct. And I think we're just scratching the surface of that. I mean, there's no money. The manpower isn't there. There's no morale. There's no civic unity that could back this. We're talking about a war of attrition here over a period of years. The only thing they can do is, the closest thing that they can come to create some kind of civic unity is a very serious false flag. Although now the American, even, you know, establishment oriented Americans don't buy the 9/11 story. I think it would be very convenient if there was something they could blame on Russia. Neither Russia or China have any interest at all in provoking the U.S., but unless something like that happens, and it has to be big, there's no foundation for this. Both Russia and China are always improving and upgrading their military equipment, usually together. They have a tremendous morale, tremendous civic sense of unity, and they have more money. And if the U.S. is getting a certain amount of its debt financing from China, it's going to be very awkward if there is a shooting war with the country. Any war with Russia is automatically a war with China. The Chinese have said that. The Chinese government has made very clear that if the U.S. keeps pushing Moscow the way it has, new sanctions have just been added to the country recently, then we will dump American dollars. We will stop financing American debt. And that's just with these threats. But Hillary Clinton has come, has said this is what's going to happen. So now you have a alliance between Hillary Clinton Democrats, the John McCain Republicans, and Gary Johnson, all over the place, is very, very random about foreign affairs, but he believed in the Iraq war. He believes in at least diplomatic support for the anti-Assad forces in Syria. He goes on and on about what a threat radical Islam is to the U.S., but will not say we need to intervene militarily. He doesn't have a solution, so it just kind of left hanging there. So he's a neocon, at least in that respect. And so now you have both parties in favor of this war, the libertarians in favor of this war. Trump is the only man who has made positive comments. The military, and now, of course, it's no surprise that there was this threat of a military coup. There was, I know from two major sources, newspapers saying it's not out of the question that the military, which is ridiculous because they support Trump to such a great extent. But if they start talking like that, I think Richard Nixon, 1976, the man who's elected by humiliating McGovern, humiliating the left, and they took a little issue, something really stupid that he had no interest in doing anyway because he had destroyed his political opposition, and that was sufficient to destroy his government, to force him to resign, everything else. If Trump is elected, this country is going to be in chaos. If he's not elected, this country is going to be in chaos.
That's a good position for us because the status quo is death. So that's the sort of thing that, breaking this down, having radical change one way or the other, creates these great opportunities because the establishment has so broken down any trust that the American people have had in them that there's no way to be able to really keep things together as they have. I mean, Black Lives Matter people saying if Trump is elected, they're going to riot everywhere. They're going to burn down cities. I've seen them on social media and stuff saying they're going to take the fight to the suburbs. No longer they're going to be in the inner cities. They're going to take the fight directly to white America. Is that something that you think possibly could happen if Trump is elected? That before he's able to take office, we still have a lame duck with President Obama, that they could bring this fight to the majority white suburbs and rural areas. And this breaks in, I don't think, into some stereotypical militia worldview of like a total civil war, but this sort of conflict that will ratchet up racial tensions and political tensions that could be used for the benefit of the globalists.
The idea of a civil war is not crazy. I think so many Americans are dissatisfied and alienated to an extreme. I don't think it would take very much to set one off. You talk about when Black Lives Matter made and continues to make that threat. I think that according to the FBI, there's 200,000, at least 200,000 very well-armed gang members in this country, either black or Hispanic, well-funded, well-legally represented, and could outgun the police department in any major city. And all it would take is a leader to mobilize at least some of them for this kind of a war against Trump. It's easy to use him as propaganda. They could say, the Nazis have taken over. They're going to come and kill everyone in the ghetto or something like that. And it wouldn't take very much. And they have the money and they have the guns to make it a deadly battle.
Just to cut in there, I was listening to the news this morning, and in Chicago in the past, I think it was 5 years, more Chicagoans have been killed in, majority black-on-black gang violence than American soldiers have been killed in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. So when you're talking about how well-armed they are, how willing to kill these gangs are, I was just listening, it was a couple days ago, they were talking about how community leaders and pastors are having to walk children through these gang-ridden neighborhoods to get them on the school bus so the children won't be shot. And many children have been killed in these black communities through gang violence. So there's no care about human life. It's not just gang members killing gang members. It's gang members killing anyone who gets in their way, to the point where one American city has had more casualties in the past half a decade than over a decade of war in the Middle East put together and all of our deaths. I mean, that's a pretty staggering statistic when you hear it.
And I guarantee you that these numbers have been deflated to keep any kind of political conclusion to be taken from it. And the racial numbers will be skewed in terms of who's perpetrating it. You know that Hispanics are now being considered white males in the official databases, at least in Texas and a few other states. So I bet you the number is much higher. Now, people make the stupid claim that crime is way down in America compared to what it was in the 70s and 80s. But what they don't mention is that police departments in the inner city have been cut by more than half. Since 2000, police departments in most American cities have been cut down by 50%. When Detroit had to dismantle its anti-gang unit because of budget cuts, right around the time where northeastern Detroit was completely colonized and taken over by the gangs, it was a no-go area for the police. I said, well, this is it. Detroit is going to be the barometer for America, and other major cities are going to head in this department. Los Angeles is since the Rodney King incident in 1992, they're now 40% of the size of what they were back in the early 90s. The LAPD. They're not equipped to handle any kind of serious gang unity, especially since, and so when people talk about the militarization of the police force, I say, well, yeah, if I were a member of those police, well, I want to be militarized as well. These guys are in a battle far more severe than soldiers in Iraq are. And in both cases, I think they're losing.
Well, and that's just the breakdown of American society. I mean, as we see the institutions have broken down. I mean, you were talking about how, in traditional libertarianism, the belief that that these organic entities, say like the church and societal structure, could come back in. And now we've seen the government, due to multiculturalism, where we've got this low trust society and all of the things that come with it, that there are no more institutions, that the churches, both in the white community and the black community, effectively don't exist as they did even 25 years ago. There are no strong community leaders. It's almost like America's cities are being taken over as fiefdoms by various warlords of these different gangs. And if they've been able I think the system can keep them under control as long as they're fighting each other. But as we saw in Ferguson, we saw in Baltimore with the Freddie Gray case, the Bloods and the Crips, for instance, came together in unity to be able to support Black Power in their own releases and stuff. They gave up to the media, them standing together, these gangs that kill each other in record numbers, coming together for the sake of blackness against what they saw as a white system that had to be fought and taken down. So there is a precedent just in the past year of these black gangs being able to come together for the sake of basically hating and attacking white people. And of course, as we all know, true black nationalists that want to be able to have a constructive dialogue and fix these problems are not given the same amount of support from the system or the media or things like that. But Black Lives Matter, you know, George Soros Front and other things are given all the money they can get, all the lawyers they can get, all the support they can get. So that sort of gang alliance, I think, is incredibly possible that can be brought against us. Now, what do you think as we come to the last few minutes of the show? Let's say, moving forward, I hate to jump into hypotheticals. I know you're a historian, but with Donald Trump being elected, I mean, if he is, and things do break out in some sort of civil conflict, what do you think is the, first of all, the possible white response, and what do you think is the ideal white response to this to make this productive for the sake of our people, for nationalist principles, and for everyone? So what do you think might happen, and what do you think would be the best way for our people to handle this in America?
Well, I think the real option will be defeat. I think the police, the National Guard, I think these people will melt away at first. You know, white policemen are afraid to shoot anybody now if they're not white, given, speaking of Ferguson and other places. I feel sorry for those guys. However, once the bodies are piling up, white people may change. And they may realize that either we kill ourselves, because inaction would be essentially suicide, or we fight back and we identify ourselves as white nationalists. The ideal response, of course, is to finally, these people wake up. The system doesn't provide the goods anymore financially, civically, democratically, or anything else. There's nothing to fight for in supporting the system. All of these groups, with the exception of the Nation of Islam, are supported by major corporations and Soros and Goldman Sachs and all that. So that my prediction would be, if civil conflict were to break out, it would initially be a complete defeat for people on our side. But then I think the tide would turn very, very quickly. Think of like the German invasion of the Soviet Union.
Well, exactly. And that's the sort of thing that I think would be very, very interesting to be able to see. And that's where I think our number one priority has to be winning hearts and minds of everyday people, to show them that the system has abandoned them, but we are fighting for them. We want to empower them. We want them to be able to have a good future for their children. Now, last question for you, Dr. Johnson. Goldman Sachs, we mentioned them a few times today, has just banned their employees from donating to Donald Trump. What does this tell us about Donald Trump, and what does this tell us about Goldman Sachs?
I have not heard that, but it doesn't surprise me at all. Goldman Sachs usually supports both presidential candidates from both parties. Last election, they gave $16 million roughly to both. Donald Trump, for them, means no cheap labor. It means no conflict with Russia. These are almost sacred goals for Goldman Sachs. No borders, everything else. They're financing this entire movement. This means that Donald Trump is our candidate. He is the candidate against the New World Order. And it would be an immediate alliance, it would seem, between people like the president of the Philippines, Iran, China, Russia, and Trump. It would be the end of the New World Order, it would seem. I mean, at its best, at its most ideal, it would seem to me be the end of the New World Order. And I think Goldman Sachs, from their point of view, is smart to do that. And I think they're in panic mode. And I think this is a wonderful time to be alive.
Well, and that's, to me, what's so amazing, because, you know, it's, I've been very cautious when it comes to Trump, because, you know, I don't want to be duped. And as an advocate for our people, there's a lot of trust that goes into that. And if Trump were to betray us, and we fully go behind him, then that would be a rough position to be in. But it is amazing, and it does fill me with hope for how things are going, just to be able to see if the bankers are explicitly, not just privately, not just in their back channels, explicitly condemning you, explicitly coming after you, because they are the most poisonous, treasonous, horrendous people on the planet. If the bankers are going after you, that means you must be doing something right. You know, that just goes to show, if you're a candidate that's promoting peace, security, you know, he was willing to go to Mexico and be and talk about how trade deals could be renegotiated. So something that we talk about in the party all the time about how we need to fix NAFTA to not only help our people, but to allow Mexico to crawl its way out of the damage that NAFTA has done to their agricultural economy. And the bankers are hating him. The warmongers are hating him. That's a clear indicator that there's something good going on. So it's, like you said, it's a very exciting time to be a nationalist. So Dr. Johnson, I always love having you on the show. It is always a great thing. So thank you so much for joining me. And as we all said, very exciting things going on, great developments. So thank you to all of my listeners for tuning in. And I'm going to look forward to being back tomorrow with another edition of the Daily Traditionalist. So I look forward to seeing you guys tomorrow and have a great rest of your day. Hail victory.
You've been tuned into the Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heimbach at RadioArea.com.